I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. To the Crimea. Matthew Kaminsky of the Wall Street Journal editorial board traveling Ukraine these last days. He's in Simferopol, which is the capital of Crimea. This is the city nearby the airport on the beginning of the crisis, when you saw men with no patches on their uniforms, clearly fit, looking like special forces. The airport was outside Simferopol, where the capital is, the capital of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea, now facing what is said to be a referendum to separate from Ukraine, possibly also to be annexed by Russia. Matt Kaminsky writing most recently about an aspect of Crimea that tells you the history of these last 100 years just in this region itself. This is living history, but with people who have a lot to lose in these pending events. Matt, a very good evening to you in Simferopol. The Crimean Tatars, who are they to Crimea? And what is their anxiety now that the Russians are looking to occupy Crimea again? Good evening.
Good evening, John. The Tatars were, you can say they're one of the oldest communities in Crimea. They came here with the Mongols in the, almost 1,000 years ago, and they ran even an independent state until they were conquered by the Russian Empire. And they've been defeated and more than once expelled by the Russians, most recently by Stalin in 1944, and to Central Asia, because they were accused of collaborating with the Nazis. But basically, Stalin wanted to get rid of the majority Muslim non-Slavic community here in Crimea. They come back. It's an incredible story. They came back without permission, without any land, without much money, and they really built up their community here again. There are over 12% of the population, or about 300,000 people almost, who live in Crimea and who are probably the staunchest supporters of remaining with Ukraine. They fear the Russians. They fear the authoritarianism of Vladimir Putin. And even though Ukraine's a bit messy and a bit corrupt and not clear where its future is, they want to stay with Ukraine, but they won't have that choice.
In Simferopol, I imagine it's embraced by the Russians and the Ukrainians. So is that going forward? Will that answer this crisis, or will that begin another crisis, Matt?
That is will just be one small step in what seems to be a very long crisis. Just to be clear, the Ukrainians here certainly don't want to support the referendum. And I think more Russians believe in the Ukrainian state. They've been Ukrainian citizens for 20 years. They're given credit for. But people are afraid here. You have to remember, this is not a situation where, this is not a question of, self-determination versus territorial integrity, as some people have put it. This has basically been an armed intervention done very fast in a very brazen way. And now you're basically rushing through a referendum, which doesn't even have a question, doesn't even give you the option of staying with Ukraine. The question is either join Russia or become essentially independent within Ukraine. I think it's not a foregone conclusion that legally Crimea will become part of Russia. I think it suits Vladimir Putin just fine to have it be this sort of unrecognized independent state, basically a Russian stateless, after the referendum. And it's really a way for him to undermine Ukraine's efforts to, reform, to move west, to become a proper democracy. And the referendum is just the next step, and I think, that's really the next step in the crisis.
In your measure of the Russian occupation of Crimea, you're in Simferopol, the capital. You've traveled to get there. You had to travel a lot in Crimea. Do you see the Russians? Are they at checkpoints? Do you see Russian rotary-winged or fixed-wing aircraft? Is there a military aura?
There isn't that much. What's funny here is that most people you see on the streets are Cossacks that have come from Russia itself, from southern Russia. These are sort of these irregular forces, and they're the ones who are guarding government buildings. You see the Russian troops, and they're finally called the Little Green Men, because they wear Russian uniforms, but they don't wear Russian insignias. They are in front of most Ukrainian military sites in Crimea. They're very well equipped. A lot of them seem to be special forces. But they're not, they don't have any, because you remember that Vladimir Putin is denying that he has any troops here. He's saying that his troops are part of the Black Sea Force. They're not leaving their bases. So these guys are technically not an occupation force. And I think if the game here is to make Crimea a kind of some sort of pseudo-independent state that's essentially a Russian statelet, that these guys are going to be the Crimean military force. And you might have a very militarized peninsula that will be a permanent irritant and a threat to Ukraine itself from the south. In the meantime, you know, you have the Russians trying to stir up eastern Ukraine, the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine, more civic parts of Ukraine. So this is really a fairly well-thought-out plan to undermine the new government in Kiev after the revolution.
Matt, the Crimean Tatars, you're writing about them very sympathetically. They were brutalized by the Soviet Union. They came back at the end of the Soviet state. They've put roots again. They're building property. They're enhancing their families. They're looking for the long term. But there was a sense that they're ready for an exodus. Is there an understanding that if the Russians annex Crimea, the Tatars must flee?
I think they have really nowhere to go. I mean, the Crimean Tatars consider Crimea their homeland. There have been some reports about a few thousand Crimean Tatars leaving in the last week or so, heading into Ukraine itself. But they're also, you know, I think the Russians for the time being are trying to buy off the Crimean Tatars. They're making promises and who knows what else to get them to stop complaining about this. It's not really working very well because Crimean Tatars, you know, have an independent television station. They have gotten used to over the last 20 years being able to speak freely, have their own meetings, run their own community. But they are, I mean, it's really a tragic case of a community that's always caught in between great powers who struggle over places like this. Now it's Russia versus Ukraine, Russia versus the West. And the Crimean Tatars are an afterthought, unfortunately. And the ones that I met to, everyone, you know, they've been briefed by their leaders about, you know, the promises the U.S. has made over the years to guarantee that Ukraine's territorial integrity is kept. Remember, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in 1994. So it's amazing that they all know this. They any American they meet, they say, what is Barack Obama going to do? How is the U.S. going to come and help them? And you feel a bit, you might probably have felt in Syria at some point over the last 3 years, people who ask there, what is the U.S. going to do? Unfortunately, the answer is probably not enough. I think they are maybe tragically the losers out of all this. In a worst-case scenario, I think it's not that hard to imagine ethnic cleansing, kind of violent retribution. Perhaps more likely, if it becomes a sort of this dysfunctional part of Russia, they would just be here and live a much better life than they, much less good life than they thought they would, coming back here in mass 20 years ago.
Matthew Kaminsky of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. He is in right now Simferopol, which is the capital of Crimea, pending the referendum to vote for separation from Ukraine. Writing about the Crimean Tatars, an ancient people in Crimea looking to stay. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. All the stars in the sky. That is a story that comes to a very happy ending when you're declaring how much you love or how much you seek or how much money you have. However, all the stars in the sky also define the ambition of all the astronomers, and especially astronomers discovering new stars in the sky. Yes, it's possible to see a new star. The most remarkable and the twist here is I learned from Ken Crosswell, writing at physicsworld.com. Ken is the author of The Lives of Stars, that with all the stars in the sky, your expectation that we've seen the stuff that's close to us is wrong. All the stars in the sky close to us, we have a new one at 6.6 light years, which is next door. Well, actually, it's on the front doorstep. Ken, a very good evening to you. Lumen Star, what is it and why didn't we see it before?
Well, good evening, John. Lumen 16 is a very interesting object because, as you point out, it's one of our very nearest neighbors. So, you know, centuries from now, if there's a future Captain Kirk and we've developed interstellar travel, we'll certainly be setting our sights on this star, which is called Lumen 16. It is only the third nearest star system to the sun. The closest star system to the sun, of course, is the very famous Alpha Centauri star system, which is actually a triple star, consists of three stars that are a bit more than four light years from Earth. One of those stars is yellow, the other one is orange, and another one is red. And then beyond Alpha Centauri is the second closest star system to the sun, and that's Barnard Star. It's located 6.0 light years from Earth. It was discovered back in 1916. And then in 2013, to my surprise, and I think to the discoverer's surprise, Kevin Lumen, who's an astronomer at Pennsylvania State University, discovered Lumen 16. And the reason that it had eluded detection was twofold. First of all, it's quite faint. It emits very little light. And second, it happens to lie in the band of glowing light that we call the Milky Way. So it's surrounded by a bunch of more distant stars if you take a photograph of it. But Lumen 16 is only 6.6 light years from Earth, and that makes it just about 50% farther than Alpha Centauri. So it's very, very nearby.
There's more to Lumen Star, however. It's a brown dwarf. What does that mean, Ken?
Yeah, a brown dwarf is a star that was born too small to burn its fuel sustainably the way the sun does. I mean, when it forms with less than 8% the mass of the sun, and for a time it does engage in some nuclear reactions as it heats up, but then the nuclear reactions dissipate, and so the star mostly glows as a result of the heat of its birth. So these stars actually start off red, and then they turn magenta, and then purple, and finally black. They're actually never brown. So the terminology, like much terminology in astronomy, is very misleading. But a brown dwarf is not brown. These are simply failed stars. In the case of Lumen 16, this new star, it's actually a double brown dwarf. In other words, we've got two brown dwarfs orbiting each other. We estimate roughly maybe every quarter century, something like that. They're about twice as far apart as Mars is from our sun. So this is the third nearest star system to the sun. These two brown dwarfs, Lumen 16A, the brighter one, and Lumen 16B, the fainter one.
There's more. 16B, is that the one with weather?
That's the one with weather, yes. These astronomers have detected what appear to be clouds on Lumen 16. The reason that these brown dwarfs are of interest, I mean, there's a number of reasons they're of interest. They're obviously a part of our galaxy, so we want to understand them for that reason. But a second reason they're of interest is that they're about the same diameter as Jupiter. And we, of course, know of many Jupiter-sized planets going around other stars, especially Jupiter-sized planets going around stars very close to their stars, these so-called hot Jupiters. And brown dwarfs are similar in temperature to hot Jupiters. The problem with hot Jupiters, though, is that since they're in the glare of their star, it's very hard to study them. In contrast, with Lumen 16, well, there's no bright star nearby, and so we can easily observe it. And plus, it's only 6.6 light years from Earth, and that makes the observations also very favorable. And so what these astronomers have discovered is, like many brown dwarfs, Lumen 16b, the fainter star in this system, has clouds, and it looks like partly cloudy skies. As it rotates, and it rotates about once every 5 hours, we actually see the light from the star fluctuate as clouds move in and
right.
out of
and
our sight.
And when the cloud is coming towards us, we can tell because of the Doppler effect. How does that work, Ken?
Yeah, well, the Doppler effect is something that we experience here on Earth with sound. For example, a speeding ambulance racing towards you, first the pitch goes up, and then as it races away, the pitch goes down. and with a rotating star. One edge of the star is moving toward you, the other edge is moving away. The edge that's moving toward you shows a blue shift, that is a shift to a shorter wavelength, while the receding edge shows a red shift, that is a shift to a longer or redder wavelengths. And by mapping out the Doppler effects from Lumen 16b, these astronomers were able to map out the cloud distribution on this brown dwarf. And in fact, if you go to the Physics World website, you'll be able to see those images that they reconstructed from this so-called Doppler imaging. And their prognosis is that the skies of this brown dwarf are partly cloudy.
Yes, but these are not rain clouds. These clouds are really cool. What are they made of, Ken?
Oh, they're quite exotic. You're absolutely right. The clouds on Earth, of course, are made of water ice and water droplets, but we know that on other worlds, the clouds can be very different. For example, the clouds of Venus are made of not of water vapor, but of sulfuric acid. And these brown dwarf clouds, at least in the case of Lumen 16b, he told me that they're actually made of silicate rocks and molten iron droplets. So, not
what I would call cloud-making material automatically. I wouldn't choose, oh, give me some molten iron and silicate rocks and we'll make a cloud out of it. You wonder what the surface is. This is a brown dwarf, so does that mean that it's really just gas, or is there anything solid below it?
It's just gas. It's a ball of gas, just like the sun. The big difference is it's just a bit cooler than the sun. This object in the temperature scale that we astronomers use, we use Kelvin. It's 1,450 Kelvin, which is a bit over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The sun is hotter, of course. It's 5780 Kelvin, or about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So the reason that this brown dwarf has clouds made of such exotic materials is simply it's much, much hotter than Earth. And so, you know, it's not water vapor that makes up these clouds. It's these exotic, basically molten rock, vaporized rocks in the atmosphere.
Part of the joy here was talking to the discoverer, the astronomer at the Pennsylvania State University, Mr. Lumen. Was he surprised that he'd found a star in 2013, and that all the stars hadn't been found near at hand?
Yes, he was. In fact, he called it a startling discovery. And I have to agree with him. I was very surprised that a star had turned up so close to Earth. We have, in recent years, found stars at, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 light years from Earth, but there's a lot more space out there. I was very surprised to find a new star within 8 light years of the Earth. It was a very surprising discovery. And I also asked him whether he thinks there's other things out there even closer, and he suspects not. He thinks that this may be, indeed, the third nearest star system to the sun, and we aren't going to find anything closer than this.
Ken Croswell is the author, most recently, of The Lives of Stars, writing at physicsworld.com of Lumen's stars. Actually, it's twin brown dwarfs, and the one with clouds is B, 16B. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Political report from the capital of Crimea, Simferopol, patrolled by the Russian army. To learn more, podcast always ready at johnbatchelorshow.com. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The Ukraine crisis now turning on the referendum pending in Crimea for separation from Ukraine and annexation by Russia. A lot in that word annexation, so I shall be careful. In these last hours, news from Crimea is that the Crimean Tatars, a long persecuted minority in the Soviet Union, returning at the end of the Soviet days, are now preparing to leave again in the event of conflict. Now, the news also spreads throughout Ukraine that the news on the television or on the radio is not 100% reliable, so keep your car full of gasoline and keep in contact with your family members just in case. I go now to Ukraine, to Lviv. This is a city in the western part of Ukraine. It is a city that has been, in the last 100 years, the capital of the Second Polish Republic. It has been back and forth between kingdoms and empires the last several 100 years. We're joined by a correspondent writing most recently in the Daily Beast, Roman Skaskiu, born in New York, now an entrepreneur living in Ukraine these last 2 years. Roman, a very good evening to you. We speak to you from the United States, watching through the fog of diplomacy and the imminence of war. You are watching this from Western Ukraine. The news there, how do you get your news? What is a reliable source of information of what's going on in Crimea, in Donetsk, way to the east, and most especially in the capital, Kiev? Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having me. I think the most reliable source for me has been social media, both the Russian-Ukrainian website called Vkontakte, which is similar to Facebook, and Facebook itself. So I'm hearing reports firsthand, and the coffee shops of Lviv are just alive with discussion about recent events.
Lviv is to the western part of Ukraine. If you look at your map, Crimea is the centerpiece of the drama right now. It is a peninsula, long Russian, given back to Ukraine by Khrushchev, the Soviet dictator, in the 1950s. But there are other regions that are under question, chiefly the eastern part, the so-called industrialized zones that have long been attached to Russia. In your piece in the Daily Beast, Roman, you point out that the Ukrainian-Russian border is 2,295 kilometers long. That is a scale that is dwarfing. What does that mean to Ukraine? What does that mean for the immediate challenges in these months ahead?
Well, let me just add that about the Crimean Peninsula, it is right now majority Russian, like 50 to 60% Russian. But the demographics changed very rapidly. 100 years ago, it was about 70% Tatar. So I think the Tatars don't have the majority claim to Crimea, but they have sort of a stronger ancestral claim. The Russians who are there are about three generations deep, which counts for something too. I'm not saying that they don't have a claim, but it does get pretty hazy when you look into history. What does the long border mean? It means that that Ukrainians and Russians, for better or worse, whether they like it or not, are going to remain neighbors and will have largely a common history. That also means, in my estimation, that Ukraine would be mistaken to rely too heavily on Western help to get out of this crisis, because that border is not going to go away. What will happen with the next crisis? The better Ukraine and Ukrainians handle this themselves, the better they will retain sovereignty.
The Ukrainian immigrants in America, Ukrainian churches and Ukrainian societies and Ukrainian romance in New York spreading through the American Northwest, now called the Midwest. You point out an important fact about the Ukrainians in America and how they view this, and how on American television and American media, Ukrainians represent the crisis. What do we need to know about the immigrant community in America?
Well, that community itself is what's called generally the third wave of Ukrainian immigration to North America. It's the immigration wave of the 40s and 50s, the people fleeing from Stalin. One very dark and little-known chapter of World War II history was Operation Keel Haul. After World War II, when Ukrainian refugees were scattered all over Europe, many of them, according to the terms of the Treaty of Yalta, were forcibly repatriated into the hands of Stalin. There were riots, there were suicides, and most of the people who were sent back were either deported or executed. It was a huge, huge tragedy, and consequently, the Treaty of Yalta required that Soviet citizens get repatriated. But Western Ukrainians were able to say, hold on a minute, we were not born in the Soviet Union, we were born in Poland. The Polish state emerged after the First World War, and it encompassed the territory that is today Western Ukraine. There is no desire, it seems to me, to fight within the ranks. And in my estimation, the arrival of a foreign army, of a NATO army, would suddenly put an end to this fraternity and force people to choose sides. There's nothing like a foreign army to, you know, create a common enemy and unite all the Russians against what's happening. Russia right now is full of internal divisions. Only 80% of the residents of Russia consider themselves Russian. There are whole provinces that have tried to secede in the past, most notably Chechnya. And those internal divisions, I think, would go away if a foreign army arrived.
Yes, it has been said of another empire that Russia is a saucepan of nations, all mixed up until and if. Let's turn to the immediate future. The head of the Fatherland Party is Tymoshenko, but the deputy is a man named Yatsenyuk. He is now said to be the interim prime minister of Ukraine at Kiev, and he is arriving in the United States to have an audience with the president of the United States tomorrow. The detail here is that the Russians reject his legitimacy, as they reject all of the interim government, saying it was appointed by a coup and that you need an election. What is the opinion in Lviv of Yatsenyuk and the Fatherland Party's grabbing power after the president fled?
I was actually at a funeral of one of the protesters, I think 2 weeks ago. I didn't know him, but I knew his family a little bit. And one of the entire speeches at the funeral given by this guy's friend who was on Maidan, who was in Kiev protesting alongside of him, almost his entire speech at the funeral was a criticism of the opposition politicians. And it wasn't pretty. It was saying, how dare they shoot fireworks like they're celebrating our victory? How dare they, steal this from us? So people are very skeptical, but they also embrace Western help. They're not listening to my advice that Ukrainians need to solve this themselves. They're sort of embracing Western help. So it's a mix of skepticism, like this isn't the right guy, he's an opportunist, he's corrupt, but they do think it will be better than what they used to have, and I have to agree with them. I don't think it's the best road, but I think it is a step up.
Yanukovych was elected by supervised elections in 2010. He fled Kiev. He says there was a coup, threats to his life. He's now in Russia, we think, last time we checked on him. Is he welcome back to challenge the leaders in Kiev, or is he a man lost in history?
He's finished. He had no support anywhere, even in his stronghold of Donetsk. There was no support. And now that his palaces have been taken over and open to the public, so everyone has seen the ridiculous opulence in which he lived, he's finished. He made a speech today that was really troubling to many Ukrainians. He said that he's the legitimate president, and sort of he raised the specter of the Russian militaries coming into Ukraine to restore his rightful presidency. But that seems very far removed from reality.
You're looking for an economic solution, but that's over the long term, if I understand correctly, Roman. That what we have now, the immediate pressing concern, is that Ukraine is in debt to banks, in debt to obligations that it has, and it needs a help from the IMF. Can you imagine the EU and Russia working together to help Ukraine, or is this something impossible, just one of those fairy tales that only work in New York?
Well, I feel like there are three separate parties, each with their own interests. One is the EU/United States, the other is Russia, and the third is Ukraine. Very early on in this conflict, I heard there was a phone call between President Obama and Russian President Putin, and the thing that they agreed on was that Ukraine should remain united. I guess President Putin sort of amended that, minus Crimea. But it seemed like they're... like both President Obama and President Putin were interested in keeping the bureaucracy intact, and they need the IMF loan to rescue the bureaucracy. In my estimation, the bureaucracy is a bigger threat to Ukraine, arguably, than the Russian military. It is so bloated and corrupt and ineffective, and very simple things like me getting permission to remain in the country, it it's just, it's corruption from top to bottom. It's like talking to a wall of meat, trying to talk to these bureaucrats. So that bureaucracy is what has to go. And my concern, which I think will probably happen, is that Yatsenyuk will negotiate for IMF loans to just uphold this bureaucracy, and it'll just remain corrupt and ineffective, and it'll create this permanent state of dependence where the new Ukrainian political class headed by Yatsenyuk or whoever will just have to keep borrowing money to keep saving these failing institutions, when the right solution is to let these institutions go to a peaceful death and just restructure local solutions or private solutions or something else.
Roman Skoskiu. He is in Lviv, east of most western Ukraine. He's an American-born, New York City-born entrepreneur living in Ukraine the last 2 years, writing in the Daily Beast. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Disney World. Disney World, Florida. A better way. Well, perhaps. Chris Palmieri, reporting for Bloomberg Businessweek on My Magic. This is an innovation that Disney World is putting in place, perhaps to make it easier for you to get to the front of the line and go on the wonderful roller coasters. I recommend them all. And perhaps also to plan ahead for your trips to Disney World and plan ahead for a young family that wants to go in 15 different directions and you want to go to MGM or you want to go to the regulars. Chris, a very good evening to you. What is My Magic? What is the promise of it for Disney?
Well, it's really a revolutionary thing, and not just for Disney, but for the theme park and maybe even the travel industry, because you're able to now reserve specific rides months in advance, as well as restaurant reservations, character meet and greets, parades, fireworks, all of that stuff that that Disney offers. You can choose it in advance.
And is it an app? I'm guessing that it's going to be on an iPhone, or is it something where you have to punch up a code?
It's both. It's both on a website or an app. Most people will use the app, and you make a reservation. First through normal channels at one of their hotels, and then you have a reservation code, and then you put it into the app.
And the challenge here for those who have not been to Disney World recently, or have not taken their family to it, or are not sure what you're facing. The challenge is that the park is very crowded and overwhelmed with people who are excited. Sometimes they're eating, sometimes they're just racing around. And you want to get to the rides, but the rides have extremely long lines. And, Chris, I'm going to be an old sentimental father here and say I enjoyed the lines because you got to spend more time with your children anticipating a good thing than ever possible anywhere else in your life. At no point would a child hold your hand for an hour in order to do something with dad. It's impossible. But Disney seems to be worried about that. Do they think this system will cut down the wait time to speed through it?
That is certainly their hope, yeah. The lines can go into the hours, and people put it up with it because, they can't leave without seeing that one attraction. They've, come all this way. And so Disney's hoping by scheduling people better, they can, cut the waiting time and know how to meet demand better, staffing-wise and things like that.
Also, they believe that it will increase the number of daily guests because, they move through more quickly? Or they know what they're going
to do. Choke points, within the park, and when everyone's congregated in one area, they have to sort of slow things down. There are times when they close the parks, in the middle of the day, don't let more people in. So this will all help them manage things better.
What is the Fast Pass system, and will that go away?
As you know it, it already has. It started in 1999 with these paper tickets, and you would go around and you'd get paper a ticket at a ride that you wanted to go on, and
right.
you'd get a designated time. You could come back and essentially cut in line. It was a faster line than the standby line. And in Walt Disney World, at their four resorts there, they've already phased that out. And so folks who are online making the reservations can pick three rides in advance, and people who just show up at the day of the park, they can also reserve in kiosks there. But the paper tickets are gone.
So right now, the new rules when My Magic goes into place is that on a particular day in Disney World, this is in the big park with the big rides, you can have three rides for reservations, and the rest of the time you stand in line.
Correct.
That's not as good a deal as the Fast Pass. Now, what are they going to? How do they make more money on this? I know it's guess, but what else do they think is going to help them?
There's a couple of ways, and some of them are quite ingenious. One of which is that they believe, and it's probably true, that if you're booked into these parks in advance and made that you're less likely to wander out and go to Universal, go to Legoland, go to SeaWorld, or any of the other attractions in Orlando. And the second way is, part and parcel of this is these electronic wristbands, so everyone wears these, and they act not just as theme park tickets and the ride reservation system, but also as credit cards. And so when you can just sort of wave, or your kid can just sort of wave a band by a reader in a store, you can imagine the damage that could be done economically, positively for Disney, but maybe not so much for your bank account.
In other words, they want people with more shopping time, and so you schedule your rides and you can shop in between. Now, it seems to me, Chris, that if you're going to use an app and you're going to communicate with the people who are in the park, you could announce lines being shorter. You could tell people if you get over to Frontierland, you can get on the boat leaving in 3 minutes. Are they planning that as well?
They are, yes. They haven't really started that so much yet, but, I'm, a member of the Disney D23 fan club, and, I get practically a daily email for them with some, special announcement, and you can imagine that happening in the park as well. You didn't get that reservation you wanted at the Be Our Guest restaurant, but, they'll make sure you know when one's available.
And it is still possible to go to Disney World and be a dope and just get in line, right? I mean, they'll still honor that several hours later.
Right. And, they've made clear that all of this is voluntary. And, there are a lot of people, studies have shown, that just really don't want to plan ahead at a park. They just, want to live in the moment. And so they're trying to accommodate those folks as well.
Now, I've saved the best to last. This is the Tower of Terror. Chris, you and I both have been through this for the first time. You were younger than I was. I was an older person with my son when he was four, and I promised him everything was going to go fine. And they have the ambiance of the Tower of Terror, and you get into the basement, and you're about to be taken up in an elevator, and there's no way to get out. I mean, you've waited too long. You're just not going to bail out, although you're pretty sure this isn't the greatest idea. And did you notice, Chris, there was nobody around to tell you what was about to happen to you? They all had those smiles on their faces, but
yeah,
they didn't say anything.
Yeah, and they have those signs that are almost as scary as the made-up ones about, if you're pregnant or, got a pacemaker, beware. And
and then they're planning on taking your picture at the moment of your most recognizing, I don't want to be here. So we're doing a public service here. Chris and I are doing this because if you've not been to Disney World with your 4-year-old or your 6-year-old, and you want to act cool when you go to the Tower of Terror, plan ahead, get your reservation, and then be prepared to be scared when you're dropped off the limits. You'll hear the scream. That's artificial. The actual scream, you scream inside. Finally, Chris, right now, is Disney World satisfied with everything the way it's going? Are they making plenty of money and they want to make more? Or are they worried about the limits of their growth? Are they thinking about a second park or growing the first park or adding a ride? Any buzz like that?
I think they're very happy with their billion-dollar investment in this. At least publicly, they say that. They just increased theme park tickets in Orlando to the point where now it's $99, just under $100 to get into the Magic Kingdom park there. And demand last year attendance was a record. So all that's moving. They have a Avatar Land coming in Animal Kingdom in Orlando, I think 2016. That's based on the James Cameron movie, and so they are investing.
Chris Palmieri for Bloomberg Business Week, writing about My Magic, the new innovation at Walt Disney World. And of course it's worth it. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show.